Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
Adam, on our show today, we get to talk with renowned cardiologist, author, and heart health advocate, Dr. Suzanne Steinbaum, about her heart book and living a heart-healthy life. A passionate woman, a very experienced advocate, and I'm just excited to talk with her.
Yes, you know, Christy, we're going to be actually talking about heart health, especially for women, and the lack of research, the lack of advocacy, the real need for more women and men like Dr. Steinbaum who are advocating for women's heart health.
It is Heart Month, right?
Yeah.
So women, pay attention, and
every
men.
Month, every month is Heart Month, really.
That's right. That's true. Okay, we've got some great research that matters before we talk with her about yoga helping with fatigue and inflammation in breast cancer survivors.
About aging and what impact does walking have on your activities of daily living?
And about testosterone therapy linked to heart attacks in men.
And then for all those peanut allergy sufferers in families, maybe there's a little glimmer of hope.
Absolutely. Let's start out with yoga and fatigue and inflammation in breast cancer survivors. So this was a study that was published in the Journal of Clinical Oncology looking at breast cancer survivors who were divided into two groups, one that did small groups twice a week for 12 weeks, 90 minutes each, and another group that was waitlisted to receive yoga sessions and followed them and measured elements of their fatigue, energy level, as well as inflammatory markers.
Yeah, so there were 200 women in this study, Christy, and what they found 3 months after the formal yoga sessions had ended, and that, you know, the twice a week for 12 weeks is not unreasonable, I don't think. Mm-hmm. They weren't like doing, you know, 2 hours of yoga a day for a week. But what they found is that the fatigue was 57% lower in those who had practiced this yoga. And that the inflammation, these levels of your body and these hormones that really are worrisome, that can cause all kinds of problems, that those were reduced by up to 20%.
They also found that the people who did more frequent yoga, who did additional yoga in between those sessions, had larger changes in fatigue and vitality and depressive symptoms compared with people who did the least amount. So, and there was also some improvements in sleep and other things. It really shows yet, it's another study showing some benefits of yoga.
Yeah, what I found really fascinating is their measuring of these inflammatory measures in the bloodstream. They're called cytokine levels. And those in the yoga group, they were less. And the more they did yoga, the greater the reduction. This tells us that there's a huge impact on this mind-body experience.
Mm-hmm. And it's measurable.
And it's measurable, and it's real, and there doesn't appear to be a lot of drawbacks. There, having done yoga, it can be more difficult, and you should do it in a group setting, and you can build up your tolerance, but it seems like this is a great alternative for some women who otherwise might be suffering with fatigue and inflammation that may not need to.
Yeah, another piece of the puzzle. Let's talk about enjoying life. This was a study looking at 3,200 people ages 60 and older who were a part of this long-term British study where they looked at people at baseline and their enjoyment of life in a questionnaire and followed them over time to see what happened to them in terms of their activities of daily living and their walking speed.
So these are things like dressing and feeding and being able to care for oneself. And they found that two or more of these activities were impaired over the 8 years of the study among up to 17% of those who said they had a low enjoyment in life, but compared to 4.5% of those who had a high enjoyment of life. And what was really fascinating, Christy, is that those who were walking and walked fast over these 8 years reported a much higher enjoyment of life, suggesting that the walking fast in and of itself, we would know, would have benefits on lots of physical functions, but it might have improved this enjoyment of life, which had impacts.
Well, but it's hard to know. Perhaps people who enjoy life more are able to maintain their ability to take care of themselves and are able to walk faster and do more things for themselves than the people who didn't enjoy their life as much. So it's hard to kind of know when we have these associations which caused which, but there certainly are a relationship found in this study. And another relationship that came was that smoking, physical inactivity, and less alcohol consumption was also associated with lower enjoyment of life. And they took into elements of clinical depression and other things. So I mean, I think we need to stay tuned on this, but maybe something about the way we view life is impacting our health outcomes.
Yeah, I think that it's a combination of things. And certainly those who were healthier, those who were wealthier, those who had more education reported
higher enjoyment
of life. But independent of all of these factors, there's something about the physical activity. We just talked about yoga. Now we're talking about aging and walking. Let's talk about our next research that matters, Christy. And this is about a really common area that we've touched on in some recent research that matters, some concerns that have been raised about testosterone therapy in men.
So we already knew from earlier studies that there was an increase in heart attack risk for men older than 65 on testosterone. But this was looking at some research of 55,000 men who had been prescribed testosterone therapy. They did chart reviews and to see what happened to them with respect to their heart attack risk.
In this particular research that is in the journal PLOS ONE, I don't know if I'm saying that right, PLOS, it could be PLOS ONE if you want to say a French term, but it was in this, which is a very, very well-respected journal, really showing that among the 48,000 men under the age of 65, there was a twofold increase in heart disease, which is similar to the twofold increase in men over age 65, and it seems to be higher right after starting the testosterone treatment.
Yeah, I mean, to me, this gives just more, just another angle of what we need to be talking about with our patients who come either with low testosterone or wanting testosterone therapy, because there's so many commercials about it these days that people come in really wanting this. And it's, we need to do our due diligence and have this conversation.
Yeah. Last research that matters, Christy, is a real short, bright spot potentially about children who are highly allergic to peanuts. And a report in the journal Lancet, a very respected international journal, of 100 children who took turns trying to maybe get therapy for the peanut allergy.
What they found is that in 6 months of rounds of therapy, of going slight increasing amounts of peanut flour under the watchful eye of doctors, this is not something you want to do at home, but more than half of the treated people ended up able to eat the equivalent of 10 peanuts at a time. And only one child ended up needing epinephrine or something for a severe allergic reaction, suggesting some hope that there might be therapies coming out. Again, not something to try at home.
Yeah, you would want to talk with an allergist, pediatric allergist, about this research. But it is, and many of these children probably are seeing one. So stay tuned, and we're excited. And that'll conclude the research that matters today. We've had a chance to talk about, on the horizon, some exposure therapy with children with allergies may be promising.
The use of testosterone therapy linked to heart attacks in men under 65 and men over 65.
About ways of enjoying life more as you're aging and perhaps with exercise.
And that yoga can lower fatigue and inflammation in breast cancer survivors.
All right, well, we'll take a short break. But when we return, we'll be talking with cardiologist and heart health advocate Dr. Suzanne Steinbaum about living a heart-healthy life. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we'll be talking with renowned cardiologist, first-time author, and heart health advocate, Dr. Suzanne Steinbaum, about her new book, Living a Heart-Healthy Life.
Thanks for being with us, Dr. Steinbaum.
Thank you so much for having me.
We are excited about your heart book and wonder if you would share with our listeners, you are a cardiologist and someone who's been an advocate for people, and what led you to write your very first book?
Well, would I say the name of the book, Dr. Suzanne Steinbaum's Heart Book, I wrote my heart book. This is the story of 10 years of my life, my career, my patients, and really what has been going on with women's heart health. We have had a movement in the past 10 years looking at women and heart disease. It began with Go Red for Women 10 years ago, and I've been involved since the beginning, basically seeing patients and going out in the community and being involved in the research and being involved in the medical community and watching this whole thing evolve. I think over the past 10 years, we have a different handle on what preventive medicine is, preventive cardiology, and we have a different understanding of what women and heart disease is. And I was in the middle of both of them right in the beginning. And so really, I wanted to tell this story and explain this is where women and heart disease was, this is the path it took, and during that same time, this was my own path. And what I've seen in my practice is what I wrote about, which is Every Woman's Guide to a Heart-Healthy Life. What has worked, what I've seen to be successful, and understanding women, understanding patients, understanding what prevention is, and taking a new approach to really heart-healthy living and to taking care of the whole person, the whole woman, our whole being. And that's what this book is about.
Well, you're speaking to converts. We live and believe this fully in family medicine with Christy and myself. And I guess, you know, Dr. Steinbaum, I remember quite clearly a decade or so ago, all of a sudden reading in the research literature that me as a family doctor, were perhaps not treating our women patients, giving them the same heart-healthy advice. Why did this occur? How did we let this happen? Is this unique?
I hate to say this, but the research hasn't been that much different even now. And I think this is what's so fascinating. There is an awareness on some level in women patients that heart disease is their number one risk. Heart disease kills more women than all cancers combined. So let's just put that on the table. But when we talk to the doctor and we ask the doctors, are you aware of the women and heart disease guideline, the preventive guidelines? A lot of doctors are aware. And the surveys show that when asked if they implement the guidelines, they are less likely to implement preventive guidelines with women. Mm. And it's a very interesting disconnect because not only do the doctors do that, but when asking the women patients, do you think your personal risk is heart disease? Only 13% of them say it is. Hmm. So as doctors and communicators and listeners, we listen to what our patients tell us. And one of the most frustrating things is that the women are saying, it's probably in our heads, it's probably not our hearts, it's probably anxiety, because they're not connecting to it possibly being their hearts. And the doctors in the back of their minds are thinking, it probably is anxiety, it probably is stress,
right.
It probably is indigestion, it's probably something else. And so oftentimes, heart disease is missed. One of the chapters I wrote about is really how to communicate with your doctor. I talk about how we figure out a differential diagnosis, how we actually hear patients, so that women will know how to speak to their doctors to get the care they need for their hearts.
You also share a story about the 62-year-old woman who had had surgery and doing well after the surgery and in that rehabilitation facility where she was recovering. She'd had a heart attack, and apparently later she said she had a feeling it was her heart, but she was afraid to say it out loud. Do you think that women are afraid to admit to themselves or admit to doctors that something could be wrong with their heart? I mean, how does that play in with what you're saying with communication?
Absolutely. I think denial is one of the most powerful things, but more powerful than that is intuition. And all of us have that intuition. I started asking my patients, did you know it was your heart? And I will tell you 99% of the time, they all say, yep, I knew it was. There is that sense that we have of something not right. And oftentimes, we know if it's our hearts, that's not right. But we have to admit that to ourselves, and we have to be willing to know that, you know what, it could be our hearts, but if it is, there's something that we can do about it. We don't have to have a heart attack. We don't have to have sudden cardiac death. We can actually be treated and taken care of before something bad happens.
We're talking with Dr. Suzanne Steinbaum about her new book on Every Woman's Guide to a Heart Healthy Life, Dr. Suzanne Steinbaum's heart book. And, you know, I wonder if you could share with us, how do you do this in your own clinical practice? You're having a conversation. How are you enabling? What words do you use? What stories can you elicit that helps women and helps all of our listeners out there feel more empowered?
I think what I say to everyone is there's something that you could do. You never, never need to get sick with heart disease. And I think that is by far the most empowering thing I can say to everybody, that 80 to 90% of the time heart disease is preventable, that you can change the outcome of your life. All you have to do is confront it and do something about it. I always joke with my patients and say, you're not allowed to get sick in my office. I don't like that. And we have a chuckle because I feel very strongly that there is always something we can do. We might need medication, and we might need stenting, and we might need other modalities, but you can live a heart-healthy life even if you have heart disease. So first, the first thing that everyone needs to do is really just look at themselves in the mirror and say, this is who I am. If I'm at risk for heart disease, I'm going to do something about it today, right away, because you can change the outcome of your life.
And you talk about this recommendation to live from our hearts instead of our heads. Is that what you mean by this, or describe that a little more?
I think this is my favorite thing to say to people, is that really know who you are, know what you need, know what makes you happy, know how many hours you need to sleep, know when you feel the happiest when you're exercising, know what makes you laugh and what makes you relieve stress, and that's living from the heart. If you take care of yourself in a way that makes you feel healthy and makes you feel happy and takes away your stress, you're living from a place where you're ultimately going to be healthy. When we talk about heart health, oftentimes we talk about, well, you got to diet and exercise. And I write the story in the book. I was doing a morning show, and all of these people were calling in the morning saying, I'm up exercising, and it was like 5:30. I would never be that person to get up at 5:30 in the morning to exercise. It would never, ever, ever happen. And so I think each person has to understand who you are. If you're not a morning exerciser, well, then don't sign up for exercise in the morning, because it's never going to stick. Make things in your life good for you, happy for you, helpful for you, and really take care of your heart from that place instead of your head, which says, get up in the morning, you got to do it, you got to do it. It's not living the right way, in a way that's going to keep you as heart healthy as possible.
Well, we're going to need to take a short break, but when we return, we're going to take the questions in our head and hear from Dr. Steinbaum's head and heart. We're talking with Dr. Suzanne Steinbaum about her new heart book, Every Woman's Guide to a Heart Healthy Life. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with renowned cardiologist, author, and heart health advocate, Dr. Suzanne Steinbaum, about her book, The Heart Book, Every Woman's Guide to a Heart Healthy Life. And before the break, you were sharing some of your passionate wisdom about us listening to our hearts and our bodies and our personalities as we make changes in our life. I know we're going to talk about prevention, but one of the scary parts about heart disease is that a lot of people might not show symptoms until they already have pretty significant heart disease. How do you recommend or how do you advise people to listen to our bodies so that we might recognize potential warning signs or seek help earlier in the process?
One of the things that I talk about in my book is something called heart throbs. But heart throbs are based on the standard risk factors for heart disease. And if you have risk factors, what that means is that you're at a setup to developing heart disease. Those are things like high blood pressure, high cholesterol, diabetes, smoking, stress, sedentary lifestyle and family history. And other things I talk about are really your ability to exercise. How long can you get on a treadmill and how hard is it for you? What your resting heart rate is matters. Things like, you know, I mentioned smoking, but are you kind of smoking? You don't consider yourself a smoker? Even having it part of your life. The other issues are hormonal issues. If you're menstruating regularly, did you have miscarriages? Things like this matter. Inflammation matters. So I also, one of the stories that came up when I was writing the book about heartthrobs, and I was explaining this to someone, and I was saying stress and depression and things that agitate us and increase our blood pressures and heart rate and inflammation, that's a heartthrob. And this one person said to me, it's kind of like when my mother joined Facebook. And I thought, well, that's a perfect example of what might cause somebody stress. But anything that actually is agitating, that could be a risk factor. So when you have all of these things and add them up, then you know if you're at risk for heart disease. Then you know you need to do something.
Well, you know,
I think one of the scariest things is that when people know they have a family history and they know that their blood pressure is a little elevated and they don't do anything because it's not going to go away and it's not going to get better. Every single person who has a heart is at risk for heart disease. If you have a family history, your risk goes up. And if you don't take care of yourself through those lifestyle management issues like stress management and diet and exercise, your risk goes up. And so understanding that and really embracing, again, I say you have to look in the mirror, know who you are. And if you really know who you are and you're honest with yourself, that's when you say, you know what, I might need to get my heart checked to see if I'm at risk for heart disease, because you want to prevent it before it catches up to you.
You know, one of the common scenarios that Christy and I see in primary care doctors and cardiologists is a young woman or middle-aged woman who comes into the hospital with chest pain, and we say we want to make sure you haven't had a heart attack, as you know, and the next day they haven't had a heart attack. We might do a stress test, and the stress test may be negative, and we say you didn't have a heart attack. It was probably anxiety, or we don't know. And it seems to me that we're missing something there, which is this whole undiscussed issues that you're starting to bring up now, which is it may not have been a heart attack, but you've got a whole bunch of unhealthy lifestyle risk factors. It's a great opportunity, just as you said, to look in the mirror. What blocks us from moving forward once we know we have risk factors?
I think that people are scared, and it's a scary thing. You know, we can't see the heart, and as people and human beings, what we can't see frightens us. And I think what becomes so important. And to talk about your story, I see this often. I see women who have chest pain who are told, well, it's in your head. It can't be real. And then I say, but it's in your heart because your heart's bothering you. So let's take your head out of it, as I mentioned, and let's find out what's going on with your heart. And so part of what occurs sometimes is that women get something called microvascular disease, which is spasming of the arteries in a way that we can't see it. We are a little bit behind when it comes to diagnosing heart issues in women. There's a lot of information we don't know yet. The research hasn't yet caught up to what we need to know. Sometimes women get symptoms when their hormones fluctuate during menopause or perimenopause and end up getting extra beats that feel like pain or palpitations or lightheadedness. It doesn't mean that it's not real. It might mean that it's not killing her, but it doesn't mean that it's not heart disease on some level. So any symptom that occurs in the heart, I just want every woman to understand it matters. And women tend to be afraid to complain because they're afraid they're going to complain and nothing is wrong. And then people went out of their way to help them, and it was a mistake. And I hear that all the time. Oh, I shouldn't have gone to the hospital, or, oh, I'm sorry I came into the office, I'm okay. And I always say, it's okay. I'd rather you be safe than sorry. And I hear this almost 100% of the time, so I think it's a woman thing. If I could sort of categorize how women think, we tend to put ourselves last. We don't want to bother anyone. We're tough cookies. We don't want to make a mistake. And at the end of the day, if you're having symptoms, it's real because you feel something. And don't discount it because it might just be high blood pressure. But it matters if you have high blood pressure because if that continues, that's going to lead to heart disease. If you have palpitations, it matters because it could actually affect the heart eventually. And so all women need to pay attention to their symptoms, even if you're not having a heart attack. It makes a difference.
Well, that is certainly an important message. We want to be sure to have time to give some take-home points to our listeners. But, you know, you mentioned a couple times that the research has not caught up with what we need to know. Certainly, your work as a national spokesperson for Go Red and this community-level education is so very important to get the message out. But for our researchers, what's the next step? What needs to happen in the next few years to catch us up?
We have to get the funding. We have to get the research out there. This isn't an issue that I'm bringing up. You know, this is Women Heart, the National Coalition, really put this out there and said there are 10 fundamental questions when it comes to heart disease that we don't know yet. And these are questions that need to be answered before moving forward to understand how to treat and how to deal with women and heart disease.
Like what?
And those
Give
10
us one
questions
example.
Are still out
uh-huh.
there, from like, knowing how plaque develops in the arteries, to how hormones affect us, to really knowing the best treatment. And it's all about the research. And as we know, clinical research takes a very, very long time, and tens of thousands of women. So if you're a woman and you hear of a research trial, you got to join it, because we need the information and we need the data.
Well, I know that we're going to put up on our link a copy of where people can order your book and get more information about this heart book, Every Woman's Guide to Heart Healthy Life, Dr. Suzanne Steinbaum. But perhaps in our closing minute, if you would just tell us a little bit about your advocacy role, because we can feel the passion. We know that you're out there on behalf of many organizations, really, really walking the walk. And tell us about how you're really advocating for women right now.
Well, this is American Heart Month. I'm a national spokesperson for Go Red for Women. And since February 1st, I've really been running around and trying to spread the message and educate and empower women to really take charge of their hearts and their health. Go Red for Women started 10 years ago by women for women to really understand that heart disease is their greatest health risk. And as I mentioned, more women die of heart disease than all cancers combined. And we take this month to really go red and live red and speak red and tell all women to tell all their friends to get checked and to know their risk factors and to do something about it. So information can be found also on goredforwomen.org.
goredforwomen.org. We'll put
that. But in my book, I really take all of this information that I've lived with and worked with and dealt with the Go Red, and really have tried to show women how practically and how successfully they can incorporate this in their lives, because I try and tell them the stories of many of the women I dealt with and also my own story, which I think makes it, we're on an equal playing field here as a woman, a mother, a cardiologist who has a really super busy life. It's not easy doing this, all of it.
That is fantastic
advice. We're so appreciative of you taking the time to speak with our listeners today about your message, an important message, and we do know it takes time, so we appreciate your time.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break, but we've been talking with renowned cardiologist, author, and heart health advocate, Dr. Suzanne Steinbaum, about her book, Heart and Every Woman's Guide to a Heart Healthy Life. We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I get to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your concerns.
And Christy, we have some wonderful questions today about asthma and about spinal stenosis.
About arthritis and back pain and about surgery and Percocet and stomach pains.
Yeah, lots of questions. Well, we'd like to ask our executive producer, Erica Lloyd, to read us our very first House Call about a child with asthma.
My six-year-old child has asthma and is coughing at night each and every night. I took him to the doctor and she said that my child was not wheezing and is okay. I think he still needs more medication than the two inhalers he takes every day. What do you think?
There's a lot of pieces to that question.
There sure is.
Where are we going to start? First off, thank you for the question.
Yeah, I think I'll start by saying there could be some other elements to it. A lot of times, asthma is related with allergies, and that's something that could bring nighttime coughing. And so that's one thing that came to my mind. Also thinking about how important it is that you go back to the doctor and say, but I don't understand, or I am concerned about this, and tell me why you're not concerned, so that you can, that some of this might be about communication.
And one of the things to communicate is that, you know, the doctor may be saying he or she doesn't hear wheezing
at that moment.
But you're coming in and saying there's something going on, and it happens to be at nighttime, which is a common time in which wheezing can occur. And yet, during the time you're at the doctor's office, maybe the medicines are preventing the wheezing. So you could still have the asthma, and you might need to have some other medications because it may not be controlled sufficiently.
So we encourage you to go back and talk to your doctor about your concerns, and thank you for sharing it with us. Let's take our very next house call, Erica.
I have spinal stenosis and I'm 65 years old. I'm on several medications, and at best, they only give me temporary pain relief. I saw an acupuncturist, and after only one session, my pain was almost gone. The acupuncturist recommended Chinese herbal medicine in the form of tea. This seems better than the potent medicines I'm prescribed. Thank you for your thoughts.
Well, you're better. Christy and I are thrilled.
I know. You know, acupuncture there have been lots of studies suggesting that it has a real role in pain and helping people with pain. And certainly doing something like acupuncture, if you're able to continue that and go back, is something to pursue and is much safer and less expensive usually than paying for a lot of narcotic or opioid pain medicines, depending on which route you go.
Unfortunately, sometimes the acupuncture itself may not get paid for, and that may be an out-of-pocket cost that may be really worth it to you in this particular case. And other times, sometimes the relief is only temporary, but so is some of the treatments that we prescribe. The relief is only temporary. So if you're doing better, we're really thrilled about it. The Chinese herbal tea, I would say, you know, talk with your doctor. There have been reports of some effects in liver toxicity on some of the herbal teas. But again, I think if you talk with your doctor, you're taking a holistic approach. We love it.
We do. And we not knowing what kind of herbs are in that or how much of it, we really can't speak to the safety of the tea. But maybe write it down from the acupuncturist and take it to your doctor, as Adam's suggesting. And good job.
Let's listen to our very next house call, Erica.
I have bad arthritis in my back and I'm really, really overweight. 2 weeks ago, my left leg gave out and I cannot stand on it. I didn't fall and my doctor says that there's no fracture. I still can't walk. What do you think has occurred?
Well, we're clearly seeing a common theme here, unfortunately, Christy, which is pain and arthritis and immobility. And in this particular case, also weight issues. We know that's a very difficult combination.
And sometimes related to your weight and arthritis, you could either have a low threshold to get another back injury that makes it hard to walk, or you could have slipped a disc in your back that is pressing on the nerves and making it especially painful. There are a lot of potential things that could have happened there.
Yeah, I worry that there's something going on here. Mm-hmm. Something doesn't seem right here. Why you can't put any weight on it. Assuming your doctor says there isn't a fracture because they either did a simple x-ray or examined you. But if you can't walk and you could walk, something's occurred and you really do need more assistance, more help, more diagnostic workup, more thoughts, maybe see a physical therapist. There's more that needs to be done here.
Yeah, and we certainly wish you the best. That kind of pain can be just really hard to bear, and we hope that you are able to get back to walking real soon.
What's our very last house call, Erica?
I'm a 30-year-old woman who has had her gallbladder removed due to stomach pain. Despite being on Percocet after surgery, my stomach pains continue. Food makes the pain much worse, and I'm not eating. Do I need to see another specialist?
Well, this is unfortunately sometimes not a common occurrence, but we see it more than we'd like to say, which is you had pain, it seemed it was your gallbladder. Took the gallbladder out, but the pain didn't go away. That happens sometimes. That's tough.
It does, because a lot of people have gallstones in their gallbladder that aren't causing them any pain. So the pain could have been coming the whole time from something else. I would wonder about if you have some inflammation in your stomach, if you have acid reflux, if you have an ulcer, or if you have that H. pylori, which can get in your stomach and predispose you to an ulcer. There are a lot of questions that I would have about your evaluation, your pancreas, other things to know if there are other ideas of where the pain is coming from.
You know, Christy, I had a patient recently kind of like this who, in addition to the Percocet, they were also taking over-the-counter Aleve. And, you know, they were taking that Aleve for the pain. The Percocet had been given from the gallbladder, but then they started having this stomach pain and they started taking Aleve. And that Aleve itself is pretty toxic to the stomach. So an ulcer of the stomach, gastritis of the stomach from the Aleve, from the Percocet. Boy, that's certainly suspicious. I'd try to get off all of those if you could.
And it's important to mention that Percocet can make you feel nauseous just because it is an opioid medication. And it can make you constipated, which would then make your stomach worse. So those are just other thoughts to toss in there. But we do encourage you to follow up and hope that you get some relief soon. Thanks for sharing. Really great questions today, Adam.
Yeah, you know, we've had a nice chance to talk about asthma and potential coughing at night as a continued symptom.
About spinal stenosis and pain relief from acupuncture.
About when things don't seem right, you can't walk, and you were being able to, really do definitely get it looked at.
And about different causes for stomach pain. Sometimes we attribute it to the gallbladder when that might not be the primary problem.
Well, thank you for joining us for Your Health. We hope we've addressed issues that are important to you. You can email us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or search for our health app on iTunes.
We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Suzanne Steinbaum. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page. We'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.